introduce Dr. William Courtney. Dr. Courtney has seen over 7,000 patients whose diverse medical conditions have provided him with an education that has driven him to understand how a raw diet, especially raw cannabis, interacts with every cell of the body. He has a BS in microbiology from the University of Michigan. He earned his Doctor of Medicine from Wayne State University and interned for residency in psychiatry at California Pacific Medical Center. He went on to earn his postdoctorate in forensic examination and forensic medicine. Dr. Courtney is currently a member of the American Academy of Cannabinoid Medicine, the International Cannabinoid Research Society, the International Association of Cannabis as Medicine, and the Society of Clinical Cannabis. He's also been teaching continuing medical education courses in clinical cannabis. And I could go on and on, but I think that that's pretty sufficient. So I'm very, very happy to welcome you this morning. Good morning, Dr. Courtney.
Good morning, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Where are you speaking to me from?
Speaking from a rainforest. We're on an island kind of close to Venezuela. And it was such a change from the weather in Northern California. This is the dry period, theoretically, but we had over 100 inches of rain last month. So it is a capital rainforest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what takes you to Venezuela, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, it's not Venezuela. It's
near Venezuela. Yeah.
An island close to Venezuela.
What country is it, actually?
Dominica.
Uh-huh. Well, it's nice that you can talk so easily from there. Before we get into the endocannabinoid system, which I'd love you to give us the 101 refresher course in, I wanted to talk to you just a minute about tracking patients. I know you have created a patient network through Cannabis International, and I understand you had some spam on that forum, and you're vamping it up again. What is the forum, and why are you? What do you hope to achieve with it?
Well, since we've been here, we've completely rebuilt Cannabis International so that it now can format on the fly so that it can be seen on a tablet conveniently and also can be accessed by cell phones, because most people in the third world, if they have internet access, it's through their phone.
Mm-hmm.
So we've shifted the website in that direction. But the particular one that you're referring to, the forum, is a place where people can tell their story in terms of what condition they've had, how long, what they've tried in terms of Western medical treatments, their familiarity with heated and maybe unheated cannabis, and their current management. And there are many millions, if not billions, of people in the world that do not live in Mendocino-like environment, or they don't have a supportive community. And so their whole access really is kind of over the internet. And so I had hundreds of patients last year who said that they were going to put their story up on the forum, but it got severely spammed and we had to take it down. And I'm now asking them, hopefully they saved their personal vignette and they can email it to me personally at courtney@mcn.org, and then I will post it, and I'll be like a firewall between the spam machines and what actually gets on the site, so that we don't have that same condition again. But it's so critical for so many people, because when they can, if say they have rheumatoid arthritis, or they got heart disease or cancer or seizures, diabetes, if they can go to a site and read the stories of three or four people who had that condition and what plants, how much, how often, how they use it, the more specific the details, the more educational it is for people in Slovenia and China and the Philippines and South Africa, and as well as in the Caribbean.
So people can go online and read other people's stories who have the same condition, if they have a condition?
Yeah, they're sorted. There's like eight categories, and then there'll be a large other. And so I'll post if you got an inflammatory joint disease or rheumatoid arthritis or another ankylosing spondylitis. If you have a condition, we'll kind of cluster them. But they have so many patients with very unusual conditions, We probably would not be able to set classes up for all of them, so there will be a large other for the real unusual conditions that have been responsive to raw cannabis.
Is that a site ready to go, or how will we
know? It is. It's, if you go to cannabisinternational.org now, you'll see the new format. And actually I'm asking people to try to look at it on their phone or try to look at it on their tablet and send me feedback at, once again, courtney@mcn.org.
Okay.
I'm sure it'll take some reiteration to get it finally refined, but that's what we're here to do, is to make it very accessible to people the world over. And the forum is the way that they convert scientific stories into practical experience. I use this much of this strain this often. I mix it with these vegetables for palatability. And so the really concrete specifics are what other people are desperate to find. And that forum is the perfect avenue to help people figure out the way forward.
Right. We're getting a little ambient noise on your end of sounds. So if there's any way you can keep them a little bit good, because it all comes through and it's a little distracting. So great. Well, if you could, let's start with before we talk about specifics of the successes you've had with raw juicing and other applications. Give us a brief summary, Endocannabinoids 101, if you would, about the body's endocannabinoid system and why cannabis interacts so well with it.
Well, I mean, it's just been a remarkable progression over the decade of studying cannabis, and we're now at the point where studies in ultra-low-dose THC are really mimicking or beginning to understand the benefit of leaf, because obviously many people throw away bags and bags of leaf because it lacks the ability to induce a psychoactive effect. But the rest of the animal kingdom, they just munch on the raw plant and appear to have all that they need. And now we're finding out that the amount of THC that's needed is, there's one study that says it's 100 micrograms, which compares to the amount of THC in a psychoactive brownie. A simple 1X brownie or cookie is going to have 10,000 micrograms. And so the question is, how could 100 micrograms be of benefit? Well, in fact, what we're now finding out is that it modifies these enzymes. I ran into a term recently called survival kinases. The kinases are a whole cluster of very important enzymes that take external cellular signals, like a cannabinoid attaching to the outer membrane or any trophic hormone, and turns it into intracellular messages that go to the DNA and result in the production of protein. So it kind of mediates the signal into an output product. And so these kinases, these survival kinases, are a very awkward collection of molecules that oftentimes have multiple names. So if you get into the literature, it's a little confusing.
Right.
It has confused me for some time. But the important thing to know is that these enzymes, THC changes the enzyme, and once they're modified, they provide a beneficial effect, not for 7 hours, not for 7 days, but for up to 7 weeks. So this single dose of THC, which is 1/100th of a psychoactive dose, provides cell protection from carbon monoxide, phenobarbital is an anesthetic that produces a neurologic deficit, provides protection from LPS, which is a bacterial cell wall product that produces an inflammatory response. PTZ is a drug that induces seizures, protects from seizures, protects from ischemia. So a very, very wide array of cellular insults are mitigated when you alter these survival kinases. And interestingly, there's a lot of papers on preconditioning and post-conditioning, because amazingly, you can actually have a heart attack or a stroke, or you can have a serious ischemic event. And even if you give the cannabinoid after that event, it still is beneficial. But obviously, if it's present before, if it's a preconditioning maneuver, meaning you give them the THC before you induce a stroke, it's ideal. From the pharmaceutical point, how do you get people to take medicines for a condition they don't have yet? And it's been difficult for them to figure out how to approach that. But dietary cannabis is the perfect solution when you are looking at it as a leafy green vegetable in your salads and your dressings and blended in drinks. And it therefore is present. And if you use small doses, which is how deer and bear and boar, they just take a mouthful of leaf, and that probably is the adequate dose for a day or two, maybe two or three times a week, maybe four times a week. And that dose keeps their survival kinases in tip-top condition, meaning that as the old survival kinases break down and new ones are formed, the new ones are modified immediately because it's continuously in the diet. And so food as medicine obviously is where my heart and mind has been, and we're beginning to see the scientific structure supporting that. And so that to me is one of the more exciting recent discoveries. Psyche is S-Y-Q-E, a vaporizer. You can go to YouTube, take a look at that. That's a vaporizer that you can resolve down to 100 micrograms. Every other vaporizer is providing 10, 12, 15,000 micrograms. So why would you build an incredibly elaborate, expensive vaporizer that provides you with a non-psychoactive dose? It really is the first kind of entry into the marketplace based on this, what they call ultra-low-dose THC. But in fact, it really is, be more accurately described as the physiologic dose, because that's the dose that deer and bear and boar and wild turkey and everyone else consumes. It's only ultra-low when you compare it to our historic use of the plant, which is really an ultra-high dose that, no pun intended.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you still there?
I am still there.
Oh, okay. Why does some people have endocannabinoid deficiency, or does everyone have some endocannabinoid deficiency?
Not everyone has an endocannabinoid deficiency, but the terpenocannabinoids, the 10-carbon, 15-carbon terpenes, the 20-carbon cannabinoids, those are a dietary essential, and in their absence, you have deficiency syndromes, which pretty much reads like Harrison's internal medicine book. I mean, we're now labeling these receptors by the organelle inside of the cell. So there was a paper at ICRS on MTCB1, which are mitochondrial CB1 receptors. Well, we're finding CB1 receptors on the nucleus. There's a synthetic pathway which brings in raw materials, builds a product, and excretes it. So this cell makes gastric acid, this makes thyroid, this makes adrenaline. Those are all cell products that are produced by a cell. And all of those organelles have not only the CB1 receptor, but the CB2 and the GPR55, and quite likely a lot of the other receptors, GPR18, GPR35, GPR119. So we're in a very early state of our understanding of this intracellular regulatory system, but we're excited where it's going, and with this new confirmation that a small amount of THC modifies enzymes, and those enzymes provide protection from a wide array of stressors for almost 2 months, it puts us on a whole different tangent in terms of realizing that cannabis, raw cannabis as food, is really what everyone else has done for 34 million years, and there's no reason for us to reinvent the wheel, invert the chemistry, and go from a dose of 30 to 100 micrograms to people that maybe do two or three edibles a day, they could be doing 30,000 micrograms of THC in one day. And another animal the same size, another mammal their same size, could be doing 30 instead of 30,000.
Uh-huh. Is there such a thing as too much raw cannabis? Can you overdose from raw cannabis?
I've only known a couple of people in 5-6 years who said that they had any kind of a psychoactive effect. And this, there was a period when I was advocating that individuals consume mature flower, mm-hmm. thinking that one mature flower is going to equal a lot of leaves. And I had a child that was doing hundreds of leaves. So I was thinking, okay, an 18-gram wet weight bud could equal a whole bunch of leaf, which is a lot to process and to consume. And so, but we noticed that a lot of animals don't eat the bud. They continue to eat the leaf, which is in their environment in 6, 7, 8, 9 months out of the year, but they tend to steer clear of the bud. And it's quite likely that the bud is going to be supplying, even though it's not at a psychoactive level, I mean, it's providing maybe 6, 7, 8,000 micrograms of THC. But if the animal's looking for 20 or 30, it really it is shying away from the 5, 6, 7,000 microgram doses for some reason. And presumably, if you look at some of the literature, a really interesting early article in 2002 by Nias Agil, the modulation of this of these kinases, which are RAS, RAF, MEK, and ERK, noticed that a sustained low signal is a common feature of cell proliferation, and on the contrary, sustained high activation is associated with senescence and apoptosis, which is the rupture of nuclear membrane and the death of cells. And so there can be correlations between dose, and there's the thought being that if 100 micrograms is, you know, it would be like whatever your 250 milligrams of vitamin C, if that produces one effect, what would be the effect of doing 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C? I mean, it's quite likely that extremely high doses, while they can produce an effect that has great interest, the integration of that into a regulatory system that's found inside of the cell is probably less than ideal, in the sense that, you know, if you've got a very complex 4, 5, 6 receptor system regulating energy production and work product from the cell, you would really want to support that equitably, meaning a little bit for the GPR55 receptor, which are the acids, a little bit for the CB1 receptor, a little bit for the CB2, a little bit for GPR18, and that once again goes back to the cannabis as a raw food product used by just about every animal. We're in the process of doing some videos. We've got these land tortoises that are these huge animals, but they love raw cannabis, as do the rabbits and the guinea pigs. And every other animal kind of knows that they're useful.
A lot of plants contain some cannabinoids. Is that not true, especially green leafy plants? So it's not just cannabis.
It's not just cannabis in their trace amounts, but cannabis is a stunning tour de force presentation of we're up to 150 of the cannabinoids and 130 terpenes. And so it, I think, you know, pretty much has a corner of the dietary leafy green vegetable area tied down. Other things do have it and are useful, and other vegetables have other products that are important for, you know, cellular health. And,
mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying that cannabis is your only food. It just it fits in well with a well-balanced consumption of other vegetables, and particularly in the raw state.
Right.
Quite probably.
Well, if you just tuned in, my guest is physician and medical cannabis clinician, Dr. William, THC cannabis versus eating the raw leaves. There was a discussion about this at the recent Emerald Cup, and how quickly the body can recover from high doses of smoked THC cannabis. But talk a little bit about the relative advantages of raw versus smoked. I know it's a kind of controversial territory, but it's of great interest to lots of listeners and to me.
Many of my patients, you know, started out with smoked, and some of them did that for 2 or 3 decades. And then as they acquired a bad hip, shoulder, elbow, and they got older, they were smoking less recreationally, and they were more interested in just kind of getting up and moving in the morning and getting things done. And as you move from doing 10, 20, 30,000 micrograms a day to doing 30, you don't have that immediate psychoactive effect that we are very trained to expect and enjoy and associate. And it's the presumed highest and best use of the plant is to smoke it. But no other animal obviously has the ability to dry heat, smoke, and make products out of it. And when you use the raw cannabis, now that we know that an ultra-low dose is sufficient to provide 7 weeks of cellular protection from everything from infections and seizures to ischemias, a loss of blood supply, and various insults, bacterial. Are any of those benefits possibly traded off when we go from 30, 40, 100 micrograms up to 30,000? And there's thoughts that half the population in the U.S. refuses to use cannabis in any form. You know, and it's against the church, the religion, the political party, the state politics. And then another half really enjoys the psychoactive as an alternative possibly to alcohol. I believe that both of those parties have different relationships to the plant, but I think the individual in the middle and all of animals for millions of years, their use of the plant is in the direction of cell health. And since they don't know that they're missing the psychoactive enjoyment, their use is restricted to meeting their dietary needs. And I think those are being... The development of an adequate intake, which is an AI, is based on science research, and that's supposed to meet the needs of 50% of the population. And so I think we have plenty of evidence to support a 30 to 100 microgram amount of THC, and quite likely that could be reduced to a smaller amount if you're using it once or twice a week over a two-month period. And so with an adequate intake, we can start doing clinical dietary studies, which is what we're hoping to do if it is acceptable down here. And then that would lead to the development of an RDA, a recommended dietary allowance, which is supposed to be sufficient to meet the nutritional needs of 98% of the population. So first you do a trial run, and then you refine that amount, and then you end up with, what are the deficiency states? And we touched on that earlier. People that have a central cannabinoid deficiency syndrome are more likely to have a genetic disorder in the synthesis, binding, or degradation of the cannabinoids. And there are a couple hundred amino acids. Any one of those could be substituted, resulting in a shift in function. And when you shift the strength of the binding or the rate of formation, you affect the tone in the cannabinoid system. And so it's quite certain that there have been papers where there are dozens of cannabinoid deficiency syndromes, which are a single amino acid and genetic disorder in the protein side of that system. And that is going to be an ever-increasing area of study as we go forward.
One last question about smoking THC. At the Emerald Cup, there was someone, I don't know if it was you or someone else, said that it takes about 28 days for the body to sort of reset itself after smoking large amounts of cannabis daily. But the one organ that didn't necessarily spring back as quickly was the hippocampus, which I think involves a memory. Is that your experience or your observation?
It's not so much my observation, but it certainly is very plentiful in the literature. I am less kind of involved in that area because I'm really thinking that, this 30, 50 micrograms, mm-hmm. If you're a 200-pound deer or boar or a small black bear, the amount of cannabis they're using to meet their needs, which they're more intuitive and it's more based on a whole different sense, is so dramatically different than the person that is doing 30, 40, 50,000 micrograms a day. So the effects of 30,000, 50,000 micrograms. And what's really strange is you take a plant that's very complex, and when you heat it, you completely invert the chemistry. You take the enormous amount of THC acid, the acids which generally act at GPR 55 associated with tumor growth and metastasis, and you destroy all them, and you create a tsunami of CB1 receptor stimulant. We now know that the receptors are on the mitochondria in the cell and on the nucleus, and that CB1 receptor is intimately involved in these survival kinases, and these are these enzymes that a very small dose changes their structure, and they continue to provide benefits for almost 2 months. And so, to weigh in, it'd be like, the normal dose of of Valium is 5 milligrams. Well, let's study what happens if the individual takes 50,000 milligrams of Valium. There will be an effect produced, and it may have other impacts. But to me, the little brain power and time I have left, I'm just focusing on cannabis as food as it's used by every other animal for the last 34 million years. I'm trying to put that information on the table so that it's part of the discussion, and that people that may or may not like the psychoactive effect still realize that there's a lot of benefit from dietary cannabis that is really disconnected from whether or not you prefer the psychoactive use.
Right.
And if we can say that.
If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. William Courtney. He's talking to us from an island near Venezuela. So if the connection sounds a little bit staticky and there's some voices in the background, it's also very rainy down there, I understand. So probably the kids are playing inside. Let's talk a little bit about CBD. You haven't mentioned high CBD cannabis. Does that play a role in your juicing? And if so, what?
Animals will tend to walk by high CBD plants. And I spent an enormous part of my life advocating strongly and working with individuals to increase its provision. My last business card included both CBD acid, and I put CBD back on it because there's nothing wrong with CBD. But what I believe is that the amount of CBD to CBDA in the living plant is in the ratio of 50 to 1, that there's 50 times more cannabidiolic acid than there is cannabidiol. And so I believe that all of them, cannabichromine, cannabichromine variant, cannabichromic acid, that they're all useful. And what I like about the plant is that it's put together this medley or this incredible arrangement of these molecules. We don't even know what's in the plant. We don't really understand the scope of the receptor system in the body that relies upon endogenous cannabinoids produced and its regulation. And so it's like, we're so eager to jump in and fix something that we're not certain is broken yet. Now, yes, you can produce an effect, and if you AI, besides adequate intake, besides artificial intelligence that Stephen Hawking says we should be a little careful of, J2 and AI is a bit of an issue. It also is it's an active ingredient, and this whole pursuit of what is the active ingredient is so reductionistic to be embarrassing. And yet that is the model of the pharmaceutical industry. It's like, mm-hmm. Identify the active ingredient, purify it, put it in a small bottle, keep the price at a cost that people in the third world can't avoid it, set up trans-Pacific pact, prevent knockoffs, keep your profits high. I mean, I just really am opposed to active ingredient analysis because I love CBD, but I love CBDA, and I love THC and THCA and all of them. And I certainly respect that if the plant wanted to have 50 times more CBD than CBDA, that would be the way it was assembled.
Mm-hmm.
And what to me is a guiding light is that if you put 10 different genetic strains into the sacred forest, and let the animals decide what strain they like. And that was a project last year. It was asking people to put motion-activated camcorders out there, label the plants clearly. And it's clear that many animals are very selective. They'll walk by 8 of the strains to eat a particular plant. Are they attracted to a sweet terpene? Are they avoiding bitter terpenes? Is it simplistic, or is it based on something else? But in general, they appear to walk on by our 20% CBD plants that we were so proud of. And so it's like, it's like, just sit down and listen. Look, pay attention, be present. And, when you decide to really improve upon 34 million years of evolution, you know, don't put a Terminator gene in there so you can maximize profits, or Roundup Ready genes. I mean, this plant deserves so much more than short-term profit.
You're talking about breeding for, in this case, high CBD genetics, and that's seems to use sort of single limited in an approach.
I think, you know, it's just the typical human, CBD is the active ingredient, and so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to make a strain that has a massive amount of CBD, and that's going to make it, I can make so much more per acre and produce so much more product and make so much more profits. You know, to me, it's a reduction of the complexity of this plant when it grows unfettered and unconstrained and unhybridized to really provide us and meet the needs that we don't even understand yet. So I tend to think that it had stuff pretty squared away before we started getting involved with our various priorities and agendas and have chemically shaped this plant to do our bidding.
Right. We're going to take calls from listeners at 40 after the hour, and that number, if you have a call, comment or a question for Dr. William Courtney, you can call 707-895-2448. And we'll take your call. Back to CBD for 1 second. I keep reading and hearing about great effects with high CB cannabis on childhood epileptic seizures and epilepsy in general. Can you confirm that, or do you think that's...
Essentially, it was one of my patients that really opened up that whole area. Kind of single father with a child who had gone through all the anti-epileptics, all the experimental European drugs with no response. And he had a single nucleotide shift in his sodium channel. He was formally diagnosed with Dravet's. His father was a carrier, but the father was just so dissatisfied with Topamax that just left him kind of drooling and just had horrible side effects. They started working in the area of cannabis. I mean, you look at the federal patent, which is now being licensed to Cannalife for exclusive development in area. And on the first page, it talks about all of the roles of cannabinoids in epilepsy and seizures. And so this father just started plowing through the strains. And by that point, we had finally found, you know, one-to-one plants, 50% CBD, 50% THC, no benefits, two-to-one, twice as much CBD, no benefits, three-to-one, minimal benefits. And then we finally stumbled on one of these high CBD plants and produced a high CBD oil. And his child, in fact, did have significant benefits. I mean, went from 300 to 400 a day to a couple a week. And then he reached out and provided to the rest of the world. And there's a group in Colorado that he got started. And so, I mean, it definitely has a role. And I've had a lot of patients who were on just CBD, and then we came along and added back CBD acid as we became excited about that 3 or 4 years ago. And there was another whole level of improvement in terms of interpersonal prefrontal cortical improvements, relationship issues. And there were some kids who had been resistant to CBD but had a strong response to CBD acid. And so it's CBD is very important. Tried to present a paper at it on that particular case, and it was not accepted. It turned out that during that session of ICRS, they were soliciting doctoral students to do research in this area. We ran into one of those fellows, because it's a five-day conference, and he goes, "Oh my God! You know, they just asked me to research the role of CBD and seizures and severe coagulopathies or channelopathies." And the guy said, "You know, they should be talking to you because you've done all the research. This is exactly what we're supposed to be doing." And you know, now they've got a product on the marketplace, and I believe that product is going to lead to the removal of CBD access through dispensaries, and you know, they've now converted it into a pharmaceutical product that will be controlled. And so that throws us back onto food may be our only access, uh-huh. as this plant is tied up. And
see, we have a call, Dr. Courtney. We'll take that. Hi, you're on the Cannabis Hour. What's your first name and your question or comment for Dr. William Courtney?
My name is David. I suffer from wet macular degeneration, which I'm based on my research and my doctor's information, is a result of excessive production of vascular endothelial growth factor in my eyes and causes this disease. I've been taking cannabis, high CBD cannabis, orally, a tincture, but 24 to 1. I started at 10 milligrams, and the results have been somewhat uncertain. I wonder if Dr. Courtney has any experience with this, and it's obviously, and I'm led to believe that the use of cannabis for cancer is also used for to downregulate VEGF, which is needed to produce capillary growth for tumors. So I guess I'd like his comment on this.
So in terms of cancer, first, you know, the ability to stop the formation of new blood vessels is fairly well established. A very exciting paper on the antigen-presenting cell, which is a macrophage that kind of lies dormant until it sees an abnormal organism or an abnormal cell. Then it ingests that cell and processes the cell markers and migrates, presents that information to the lymph nodes that then mount a response that goes out, ruptures nuclear membranes, and will kill each and every cell that has that cell address on it. So, and then the maturation of that antigen-presenting cell, also called the dendritic cell, is under cannabinoid influence. And so supporting sagaciously that cannabinoid system could upregulate a system that may be a little less than optimal. I mean, some people are more prone to cancer, and then you can have viruses in the genome. There's a lot of things that can predispose you, but one of them could be your immune function. And the thing about this plant is that I don't believe it really cares what the cell is doing. It is there to take the directions of the nucleus and make sure that the energy from the mitochondria matches the incoming raw materials to produce a product that's in regulation and in keeping with the whole organism. So if you try raw cannabis, what you're doing is you're going to be supporting regulatory systems and cell health. And in general, that's where disease arises, and that's where disease is best addressed. An interesting side paper was on GPR119, which is associated with some of the intraocular pressure things. I mean, how many people have heard of guanosine-coupled protein receptor 119? You know, we don't even know the scope of this system in regulating, but we would assume that the body is trying to restore normal function, and it is going to be using this system. And speaking of that, tamoxifen, if you can repurpose a drug, you can save $1 billion. And so tamoxifen, great for breast cancer, used, you know, quite widely. They were saying, well, is there anything else we can do with this? And they found out that tamoxifen is the first known positive allosteric modulator of the second cannabinoid binding receptor. Until then, there was no PAM for the CB2 receptor. And then all of a sudden, in the repurposing project, they found out that, well, tamoxifen is really good if you have an infection of worms. Well, how is an anti-cancer drug good for treating a worm infection? And it turns out that, you know, it looks like it's going to have a wide array of utility, because if you enhance the function of CB2, you're going to accelerate a lot of, it's a very reactive receptor that, you know, is installed on the membrane in states of disease. And so you enhance that function, you're going to complement the body's regulatory system. So not knowing that specific condition, but knowing that disease rises at the cellular level, and when cell regulation is supported across the board, I mean, you're not taking a single cannabinoid THC and hitting it with, you know, with 50,000 micrograms when it's looking for, you know, 20 or 30 micrograms. You're supporting GPR55 and CB2 and CB1, and GPR35 and GPR18, GPR119. And so I just, unexpected results occur because you're supporting cell health. And and so for cancer, you're supporting the recognition of self, non-self, and the mounting of an apoptotic immune response, and so as well as anti-vascular. And there's, you know, many, many areas in the oncologic area that we're excited to be looking at I don't know if I addressed both questions. I kind of forgot what the, but I think I covered some of them.
Well, my question was, do you know anybody using cannabis for macular degeneration? And if I'm taking I'm taking a high CBD flower tincture, which I don't think is cooked, but is not heated, but maybe I should take less instead of...
The problem is, because it is a Schedule I drug that has no medical benefits, I believe, and I think this plant is put together very, very well, and, you know, it doesn't do the active ingredient approach. It's not like this got more CBD than anything on the planet, and the rest of the animals going, yeah, and let the humans eat that thing, because we're not going to touch that. we need this whole plant to be effective. And so we get drawn to, kind of promised solutions, and, you know, I certainly don't want to say anything kind of against it, but if it's not giving you the relief you're looking for, it's a pretty innocuous trial to consider using the whole cannabinoid profile and seeing if that is a response. Because I've seen people that had vasculitis in the pulmonary system and were just coughing up blood, and I thought they weren't going to live. And then a couple of years later, they walk into the office and they're out walking around, and you know, it just is quite phenomenal. And it's only phenomenal in that it supports cell health. And if there's a dis-ease, it generally arises at the cellular level. So if you can support cell health and the restoration of health, I think you can have an impact on disease wherever you find it.
We've got another caller here. I'm going to take that call. Hi, caller. This is the Cannabis Hour. You're on the phone with Dr. William Courtney. Do you have a question or a comment?
I have a question. I'm hoping I was on the phone, so I'm hoping I didn't miss the answer already, but I was interested in CBDs and dogs and what the best delivery method would be.
There was a woman in Los Angeles, and the dog thing, I remember I was really trying to get the veterinarians to do, you know, crash research, you know, because it's not involving humans, and we could do things quicker and faster and get some studies. And so I don't really know the whole legal side of it, but I know people that are making dog bones with, you know, some cheese in it and CBDs, and they're having a very potent anti-inflammatory effect on arthritic hips. And once again, that is an identified molecule. I mean, I had it on my business card for years, and I've spoken about it for years, and then I switched over to CBD acid, then I switched to both of them, and now I'm gravitating towards, you know, simply cannabinoid acid, and may be involved in stem cell modulation. And so if you can upregulate stem cell function and reproduce cartilage and have effects on restoration of health, you certainly don't want to create a plant through pressure hybridization to where 99.99% of the entire cannabinoid content is a single molecule, when this one over here is the one involved in stem cell upregulation. You know, so we want a solution so desperately that we sometimes do things that are desperate and that may not be in our best interest.
Thank you, caller.
And thank you.
I wondered if you could, Dr. Courtney, what does somebody do who has a health issue who needs to find a physician or someone who can advise them on dose and strain if that's an issue? What do they do? Who do they call?
Well, I'm actually scheduling for renewals. I know I'm kind of cleared to see people that I have previously examined and are patients, and so they're established patients. So we're now, and I'm so excited to get back to the people that I've known for a decade because of these various studies that are so important to the whole rest of the planet. I do consultations all over the world. I can't get intensely specific because they're both from all over the world, from Japan to Ireland to Slovenia to, you know, Ukraine, all over. So And not a lot of people are real excited about dietary cannabis. My understanding is that North Korea is the only country on the planet that you can get raw green cannabis in the grocery store. And they also refuse
wow.
to, along with the central bank, they refuse fractional bank, and they refuse to enslave every member of their society to the bankers. And you know, they're one of the few places left that will not accept a central bank. So, you know, we get painted a really negative picture of them, but anyone that allows you to prevent disease, you know, has priorities that are straight, and if they support cannabis as food, you know. But short of that,
how could somebody...
You know, consultations...
How would somebody...
There are more people that are... Go ahead.
Oh, how would somebody reach you then if they wanted to have a consultation, a sort of a generic...
If you go to cannabisinternational.org, there's a fill-out form, you know, and then... Put your phone number on there, then I can call you on this internet. And in the very near future, we're going to have a dedicated office space where we don't have a lot of the ambient sounds.
Okay.
I apologize for that. But we'll have a better phone system, and it'll be quieter, and we'll probably be doing Skype, and so things will be improving hopefully very very quickly. But Cannabis International will reach me for consultations, and then the medical office 961-1420. We'll set up for renewal appointments, and if we can figure out if we can get current medical records of a physical exam, possibly as a consultant, we could see new patients. Every other field in medicine is allowed that. You know, cannabis is has a whole set of more restrictive standards that we're trying to negotiate because there's so many people, so many kids out there with cancers and seizures and autoimmune disorders that no one else really, you know, is comfortable, or maybe has not had as much experience. And you know, to live in fear of tyranny is, I guess, our lot in life.
Well, before we take one more call, I wanted to ask you: there are a lot of cultivators in Mendocino County, as you know, because you lived here. Is there a strain of THC or a kind of cannabis that you would recommend people growing that has a good balance or a natural balance or something the deer would like?
Yeah, and that really is, you know, we're begging people to do that research. You know, Sour Diesel is a big one. Blue Dream is a big one for deer preferences. But just, you know, you got a couple of culls that you can get rid of, put them out there for $100, you can get a motion-activated camcorder. Do the basic science research, you know, and say, look at that. They're just walking right by the high CBD plants. They're walking by the high THCA acid plants or THC plants. And, you know, let's learn from those that, you know, maybe have a better handle on dietary cannabis. And
you may have a hard
point,
time.
I think that variability.
Hard time convincing growers to turn their crops over to the deer for experimental purposes, but...
Well, a lot of people will put up more plants than they're going to take
uh-huh.
to fruition, so they start up more than they cull them out, and instead of just cutting them down, take the culls, put them out in the woods, and you know, you make an experiment and then cut them down. You know, so it's kind of, you know, I'm not asking you to turn over your crops to the deer, but the deer could provide you on how to better take care of yourself, and so it could be an exchange. I'll give you a little food if you can tell me which one's the best thing to eat, and then we can spread that good news around the world.
Okay. Well, we're going to take one more really quick call. I might have to cut you off because the next programmer is waiting, but here's one more caller. Hi, caller. Do you have a quick question for Dr. William Courtney?
Yes. I hope it's quick enough. I have advanced osteoarthritis, which maybe used to be rheumatoid arthritis. About a year ago, I received some buds that were supposedly ACDC, and I made a tincture with them. They were almost three-fourths of a quart of mason jar full of buds, and I filled the jar almost full of 153-proof alcohol and then used that. I had wonderful total relief from the pain and inflammations, and since I ran out of that particular strain, I've tried many different strains of ACDC and few other things, and I've gotten no relief. I wonder what you might suggest.
Dr. Courtney, quickly.
Always keeping genetics around. You know, when you're on the front edges of experimentation, you know, I've also known people where they have really good plants. They dry them, harvest, send them off, and all of a sudden they find out that, oh my gosh, I got a whole bunch of THCV or CBG or you have some unusual variant. And so it's really good, if at all, practice just to keep a small plant back and alive in case you run into something that's phenomenal so that you, for your particular condition, because there are individualized, there's an article at immune response, then you're modulating a very serious kind of condition as opposed to maybe just a post-traumatic arthritis because you fell off of ATV or something. So obviously, you know, it's, hindsight is great, but you know, going forward, always keep the plant alive. And so if you stumble on something, then you can have that in your in the library. Experimentation is sadly where we're at. And the thing with ACDC, you know, it was a feminized product, and so it had pretty explosive genetics. It ran from 22% CBD to less than 1%, and the THC ran from 1 to 30 on an inverse ratio in the sense that as they occupy the same point on the genome, so as THC goes up, CBD goes down, and so there's an inverse relationship. A cross-section can be good, and when you're eating, you can, eat from four or five different ratios and strains. And sometimes if you support a distant cellular system or organ system, while you may not consider that your primary condition, it can have a secondary benefit in advancing kind of total recovery. So sadly, I do have some genetics analysis of that strain. Like you said, you ship that strain out to Colorado, and you can call it, Charlotte's Web. You can do whatever you want to with it. But until you get down to the genetics, you don't really know what you have.
I'm going to have to wrap this up, Dr. Courtney, and call her. I thank you so much, Dr. Courtney, for being on the show all the way from an island near Venezuela. And look forward to hearing from you again.
Yes, everyone have a good day, and it's nice to be back in Mendocino.
Thank you. Welcome. Bye-bye. So I wanted to say that my guests on the next Cannabis Hour will be Julia Carrera and a board member of the Small Farmers Association. That'll be Thursday, April 21. Julia and Steve, I think she's bringing, will talk about the revised Board of Supervisors recommendations related to the permitting of medical cannabis in this county and also what's happening in Sacramento. 1 week from today, you'll hear Mendocino Currents with the KZYX news team in this 9 a.m. spot. And stay tuned now for Portrait of Jazz, coming right up with Ron Hoffer after the Pulse of the Planet.